Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
Hey, you're listening to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Mark Nguyen.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we're here today to discuss our April 2021 book club pick, How to Pronounce Knife by Suvankam Tamavangsa. I had to practice that name a couple times because my Lao pronunciation is non-existent. But it's a collection of short stories about the Lao immigrant community. And yeah, I'm excited to talk about this book with you, Rira. But before we get to that, you got your second vaccine dose this week. How are you doing?
Oh, yeah. I'm feeling much better. We were actually supposed to record this episode a couple of days ago, but I got my second shot, and unfortunately, I had low blood sugar when I got my second shot, and I tend to have, I have a fever-prone body, so I get a fever very, very quickly, so I think like within 2 minutes of getting the shot, like I got really lightheaded, and I almost passed out.
Yeah.
And the nurse was like, you're not driving back home. You need to call someone to pick you up. And I was like, that is a good thing. Yeah.
Right. Because they sit you down after you get your shot for 15 minutes to see if you have that reaction. And most people don't. I got my second shot a couple of weeks ago and my reactions were pretty mild. But yeah, I'm glad you were able to get back safely. I got a message the day before we were set to record this episode with a, yeah, it's not happening tomorrow.
Yeah, it's like, nope, not happening. Most people were telling me, oh, like, you'll feel terrible for a couple of hours, maybe for like a day. But like the next day, you'll be fine. And then day two rolls around and I'm like, I'm in a fever haze. My fever hasn't broken. I'm taking like NyQuil because like my fever is not going down. And then day three, like my fever finally broke. But when your body is fighting a fever for that long, you're exhausted. And that was the day we were supposed to record. And I was like, oh, nope. Like, glad that I canceled the day before because I'm not in the right headspace to talk about this book.
Well, I'm
made sure to get that shot after my birthday because I did not want to feel terrible on my birthday. It was not going to happen.
Oh, I'm glad you're okay. And happy that you're vaxxed. Only two more weeks until you can actually go out and do stuff. Not that there's much to do right now.
Did you hear about people making fake cards so that they can, like, go out into the world?
I mean, when I go out these days, I'm still stressed out because I'm looking around and trying to decide if I can trust the people around me.
Yeah, it's like a real-life version of Among Us. It's like, which of you guys are actually vaccinated and which of you guys are just terrible people who just want to get drunk and don't care about the rest of humanity?
Yeah. And what happened to washing your hands? I was in the restroom and like two people in front of me totally did not soap up while washing their hands.
That's disgusting.
This is why we can't
have
nice
human
things.
Beings disgust me.
I know. Well, good thing we have a feel-good book to read this month.
Yep.
It was a good book. I enjoyed it. But it definitely was not a let's feel good about humanity type of book.
I don't know. I feel like there were some optimistic and humorous stories in this collection.
Yeah. But they all had a touch of like melancholy to it. Because, well, I mean, we'll talk about it in our discussion. So let's just get into it. Our, I guess, compulsory spoiler warning. We're going to be talking all about the book How to Pronounce Knife. So if you have not read it and don't want to be spoiled on storylines and themes, go ahead and read it now and then come back and listen to our discussion. But with that out of the way, let's get to it. Rira, why don't you introduce us to the book, How to Pronounce Knife?
The stories that make up How to Pronounce Knife focus on characters struggling to find their bearings in unfamiliar territory or shuttling between idioms, cultures, and values. A failed boxer discovers what it truly means to be a champion when he starts painting nails at his sister's salon. A young woman tries to discern the invisible but immutable social hierarchies at a chicken processing plant. A mother coaches her daughter in the challenging art of worm harvesting. In a taut, visceral prose style that establishes her as one of the most striking and assured voices of her generation, Tamavangsa interrogates what it means to make a living, to work, and to create meaning.
So at the top, like, this is a story, a collection of stories about the Lao refugee diaspora. And Laos is a country, I think it's adjacent to Vietnam, but it's in that Southeast Asian like block that was involved. In the Vietnam War. And because of that, we're the source of a lot of refugees along with Vietnam and Cambodia that came from that area in, I think, the 70s, 60s, 70s?
Yeah, it was like the 60s and 70s. Laos is the only landlocked country in Southeast Asia. Like you said, it borders Vietnam. It also borders Thailand. And it is also the most heavily bombed country in all of history in terms of country size and population. And most of that is from Americans. And a lot of the bombs that were dropped, not all of them have detonated. So every year there's a lot of casualties from these bombs. Western colonization and meddling has definitely, I don't know what else to say.
It's definitely part of America's dark history. And I think there was I think it was either a film or a documentary about the unexploded bombs that came out, that ran the festival circuit a couple years ago. I think it was called The Long Walk. But yeah, it was about, I mean, there are people out there whose jobs are to find and disarm like the unexploded bombs that still litter the country. And yeah, it's really fucked up. A lot of things that America did to Southeast Asia during that time was pretty, like, it's pretty bad.
It was war by proxy.
Yeah.
Against, you know, Soviet Union versus United States. And
communism versus capitalism.
Yeah. And also just, I mean, like, the bombing of Laos and the struggle that happened there, we call it the secret war because no one knows about it. I'm pretty sure a lot of our listeners who are listening, you've probably haven't heard about Laos, or you know almost nothing about it. I think that's like pretty common amongst Americans, considering that our geography and history knowledge is not great. But I'm really glad that we were able to read a book by a Lao immigrant writer.
Yeah.
Suvan Kham was actually born in a Lao refugee camp in Thailand and was raised and educated in Toronto. Both of her parents are from the capital of Lao, Vientiane. I'm not sure if I pronounced that correctly. Probably not. They escaped by a bamboo raft, and they were sponsored by a Canadian family. And that is how they came to the country.
Yeah. So, you know, we talked a lot about geopolitics of the 70s in this intro, but this book isn't about geopolitics, not about the war. It's not about escaping. It's about the refugee immigrant experience. And I really like the plethora. Like, there are like, what, 14? How many stories?
There's 14 stories.
Yeah, 14 stories, and all kind of taking a different perspective, but all coming from this place of like alienation, of like displacement, and this kind of melancholy sense of like Southeast Asian refugees from this era are all people who lost their country, right? They're untethered. Like, we talked about this when we talked about The Sympathizer by Viet Thanh Nguyen all those years ago, but like, these are literally like displaced, unmoored, untethered people that are trying to make a new life in a country that may not actually want them there. Like, countries like America and Canada brought these people in because they felt responsible for their plight, but not necessarily because they wanted to or because they were feeling nice, right?
Yeah, a lot of the families that sponsor these refugees, they're doing it for not so generous motives. They're doing it because it makes them feel better or for tax breaks or whatnot. It's never really out of the goodness of their heart. And I really like the fact that this book, a lot of the characters in this book, they're nameless. The places that they are at are also nameless. So you get the sense of, as a reader, you get the sense of being displaced because you have no idea where you are and who the people are in the book. And also just the fact that most of the characters are blue-collared workers working these grunt jobs. And that's like the opposite of what we know as like the Asian immigrant story, right? Like they come to the country as refugees, you work hard and you study hard and you get to a point in your life where you can deem yourself successful. And none of those characters are that.
I mean, the people depicted in this book are the people that are forgotten and erased when we talk about things like the model minority myth, right? Like when we think of the stereotypical Asian story, like the model minority, you're not thinking about people from Suvan Thom's book. You're thinking about people like from our families, like myself and Rira.
Oh, yeah. Right? But the thing is, our families chose to come to this country,
yeah,
rather than fleeing their country to survive. And that's, you know, that experience is often used in media to, I don't know, like, there's like an inspirational factor to it. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, like aspirational, it's like,
oh,
right?
Yeah. It's just like, oh, they went through so much hardship and they came out alive and they're so inspiring. But all they focus on is their trauma. And with this book, there's a lot of humor to it. It's really unexpected. And there's like a lot of laughter in it.
Yeah. What was your favorite story from the collection?
I have a couple of favorites, but I think it would be good to start off with the very first one, How to Pronounce Knife. I could definitely relate to it as someone who like immigrated to this country when I was three and had to kind of like learn English by myself.
Yeah, that's different from my experience. Because my experience, I learned English and Chinese at the same time. Like, I learned Chinese from speaking to my parents. I learned English while watching television, namely Sesame Street and all those kids shows. But, I mean, I was born in Toronto, so I grew up in the West, I guess you can say.
Yeah. The thing about, like, knife, that word does not make sense at all. Because, you know, you see the K at the very beginning of the word, and it's there. But for a lot of immigrants who don't speak English, you know, like it doesn't make sense to them. And English is a very difficult language to learn because it borrows from so many other languages. It borrows from German, Latin, Slavic. So when you are not a native speaker, there's a lot of unwritten rules. And for a lot of children of immigrants, it's up to them to learn. And in a way, like, correcting your parents seems kind of wrong. And what I liked about the first story is that you have the child protecting her dad because her dad mispronounces the word knife as knife, and that is the way that she was taught. But when she goes into class and she's doing the reading and the teacher is not letting her move on until she pronounces the word correctly, she's kind of protecting her dad's integrity, telling the blonde white girl in class, like, how dare you say that my dad is wrong? And then when she goes home, she doesn't correct her dad either.
Yeah. I mean, I had a couple of thoughts about this story as well. Number one is it was refreshing to see a child of immigrants stick up for her parents, because the typical reaction, or like the stereotypical, or I guess the most common reaction that we read about, right, is the child becomes embarrassed for the parent. And that's something that I've definitely felt with my parents sometimes growing up. Like, I regret it now, but, you know, it's definitely a feeling that happens, right? Whereas in this story, the girl is like, no, fuck you. My dad says this is how it is, so this is how it is.
You know, there are words that I mispronounce because that's just how I learned it in my house, or I learned it by myself. And pronunciation, English pronunciation is hard because sometimes, like, when you read a word, it's like, oh, like, things are silent, like knife.
Yeah. And to be fair, there are certain sounds in Asian languages that are impossible for the Western tongue to pronounce. Like, case in point, my last name. My last name is Yue, and that U-E sound, no one can pronounce it unless you know the Chinese word, right? And I mean, both of us even have trouble with, you know, trying to pronounce Lao names in this book correctly, right? And it's just language is hard.
Like, for example, the Oscars this past weekend, you had filmmakers who, like, English is not their first language. And I forgot who it was. It was a French filmmaker, I think. When he was doing his acceptance speech, he said, oh, my English is not very good, so bear with me. And it's like, I think people should be able to do their acceptance speeches in the language that they're comfortable in and not have to apologize. But that is usually the mindset for a lot of Western countries, right? If you can't speak English perfectly with a perfect accent, with perfect grammar, which is still impossible for a lot of Americans, by the way, you are kind of seen as, you know, like, yeah, less than.
Take a page out of Bong Joon-ho's playbook and just get yourself a translator, whether you need it or not, because that man can speak English too.
One of the words that I grew up with and mispronounced all the way until college was receipt. And it was the same thing with knife. The P is silent in receipt. So throughout my entire life, I called it receipt. Because when you learn English by reading, no one says the words out loud and correct.
I might still call it receipt.
See,
now,
so there's
now,
like,
that I think about it,
there's receipt. I mispronounced salmon for the longest time.
That's a word no one pronounces correctly.
Like, I pronounce it like salmon for like 20 years of my life. Aloe in Korean is aloe, so I've always called it aloe, but I got like made fun of by like my classmates once. So
is it aloe or aloe?
I think it's aloe, like, really? In English. But I still call it aloe because of of habit. But there you go, right? Like, language shouldn't be policed, in my opinion. I think accents, I don't know, there's something beautiful about accents, and there's there shouldn't be shaming on people who can speak two languages, maybe imperfectly, but they can still understand and do the work in their second language. And I think our generation now is coming to terms with that, of like, let's not shame people for not speaking perfect English.
You know, I want to believe that, but for some reason, I don't know if that's really the case. Maybe it's just people we surround ourselves with have become less shitty over the years, but I don't know. I feel like kids are still pretty mean these days.
But I feel like with parents, because you and I are, you know, like, we're older, and a lot of our friends are parents now.
Yeah.
Like, they're not going to tell their kids, like, oh, you can't speak Korean. Like, you need to, like, forget that in order to assimilate. There is more of an understanding that being bilingual is not considered a curse.
I want to believe that as well, but I also know a couple people who...
Who are you hanging out with?
I mean, it's just, we're in a bubble where we celebrate, like, bilingualness. But I mean, there are countless people that I've met from, like, the Midwest or the East Coast or outside of, you know, this SGV bubble that you and I live in now, that, you know, grew up hating the fact that they're not white and never learning the language, and now there's no language to pass on. And I mean, some of them feel regretful about it and want to reclaim it, but some of them don't. Like, some of them have bought into it. I mean, that perspective is also covered in a later story in this collection, the one with The Mother, which one is it? You Are So Embarrassing, which covers the bizarro version of this first story, which is about a mother whose daughter rejected her because of her foreignness.
Yeah, and like names become a pretty big theme in this book, not with just that short story, but also a short story with the Lao wedding invitation maker. we've seen this trend of, I guess it's not really a trend. I don't want to call it a trend because I hope it stays. But you'll notice on book Twitter, a lot of Asian authors now have their Asian names written next to their handles. And we've kind of come to a point where we are correcting people more on how to pronounce our names correctly and being a little bit more proud to show our Asian names and refuse anglicizing it. And you kind of see that in this book.
Yeah. The wedding invitation maker story was one that I really enjoyed. It ends on a bummer, but the story itself, The Universe Would Be So Cruel, had like the most dunking on white people in it, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I like the fact that like the invitation maker, by virtue of having a business, could use his like what power he had to like dunk on customers that he didn't like, mainly rich white people.
Yeah, and it did end on a bummer. But I think the theme of love is very consistent throughout this collection. You know, whether it's, self-love or failed romantic love or familial love, it is like very consistent throughout the collection. And it was really heartbreaking that the father, like, instead of telling his daughter, like, your husband-to-be was a bad person. It had nothing to do with you not being enough or us not doing enough. You see a lot of family loyalty in this collection, whether it's the child protecting the parent or the parent protecting the child.
Yeah, I mean, family was a big theme in many of the stories, whether it's love between, or not even love, it's the relationships between parents and children or between siblings. And there's a lot of commentary also on like gendered relationships, right? Like between husbands and wives and what they're expected. And
yeah, you'll notice that a lot of the, throughout the stories, you have pretty strong women characters, and a lot of the men featured are either kind of like resigned or in the background. And the stories that were told from the child's perspective, those were probably my favorite ones. There's something about writing in a child's perspective that lets you explore vulnerability more, because children are more innocent and they are so trusting of their parents. They believe that their parents are always right. And you throw them into displacement where they have to like learn all of these social cues that no one is able to teach them. And it's something that I went through as a kid, definitely not at the level of these characters, but it's something that, you know, resonated with me, and I'm pretty sure it resonated with a lot of not just Asian immigrants, but also like any type of immigrants, like Latinx or like African immigrants, where you have to figure out these unwritten rules that no one will teach you.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that all the families in the stories share is that they're real scrappy. They're willing to do whatever it takes to take advantage of what little opportunities or advantages that they have. And a part of that is, I'm reminded of a section from T. Bui's The Best We Could Do graphic novel, where she was talking about refugee instincts, like living every day as if you'll lose everything tomorrow and like kind of not expecting much from your life, right? Like a theme from a lot of these stories involve parents telling their children, don't expect too much out of life. It'll only let you down.
Yeah, I
be
mean,
happy
like
with what you have.
You see that in Manny Petty with Raymond and his sister telling him, like, don't dream too big. Like, don't dream that you're going to be able to get with these rich clients, like we're the grunt work. No one is ever going to pay attention to us. And, but at the same time, Raymond's like, don't tell me not to dream. Like the fact that I'm able to dream means that I'm alive and that's worth something. And that is a very optimistic message. And
yeah,
with a lot of the trauma and a lot of the bleakness, it's balanced out with optimism and hope in terms of you shouldn't be hopeful, but at the same time, you're still going to hold on to hope because that's all you can hold on to.
Yeah. I mean, regardless of what their past was, they're in a situation now where at least dreaming or hoping is possible. You know, it might not be easy, but it's possible. And that's different from, like, you know, you and I, our families are maybe two generations removed from war. Like these, like the people depicted in this story are like one generation removed. If that, or like not even one generation removed. So, I mean, that trauma is not, you can't even call it generational at this point. It's like, it's still personal trauma.
Yeah. And with the Manny-Petty story, I like the fact that Raymond is a failed boxer. And it starts with him saying like, oh, I, like, he knows that he's never going to be champion. Like, he's just a trial horse, a body to be beaten up for the next champion to get to the next match. And, but he's able to find redemption in this new work. And even though it's considered menial and blue-collared and ungrateful work, he still finds some integrity in it. Like, you do the best you can do with what you're given. And you notice that a lot for these stories. Like, work is a big theme. Like, the quote-unquote hustle. Like, how does that shape the immigrant experience? And like you said, like, you, there's refugee instincts. You live as if you're going to lose everything tomorrow. And you're grateful for whatever you get.
Not even that, but they're also all like it's blue collar work. It's work that you don't like. It's work that people don't think about as work, right? Because it's people doing service, like not even service jobs, like jobs servicing others, right? Like, I've never gone to get a mani-pedi, but you know, reading the story, like, I wonder how many people going in for their manicures and pedicures think about the people doing the work.
Probably not. Not a lot of people think about them. And and like, unfortunately, for mani-pedi, it kind of delves into this a little bit, but like the dangerous work environment and the cost of working in a nail salon where, like, there's some harsh chemicals, it impacts people's health, but you don't really have a choice. You just have to keep working. But yeah, like, for a lot of the work that the characters do, it's either their hard work gets ignored or they do work that they love, but the value of it isn't seen.
Yeah, I mean, that's most apparent in the last story of the collection, Picking Worms, which, like, if that is not a story about mediocre whiteness trumping, like, hardworking people of color, I don't know what is. How did you feel about that one?
I mean, we know that success is often tied to race. Privilege is tied to race and also colorism and class. And it didn't surprise me that you have the mother who has a system of picking worms very effectively. And it's very weird work. Like, you wouldn't consider it to be work. And it's menial, but she does it with pride. She loves it. And she teaches this 14-year-old white boy all of her techniques. And because he's doing it for free, and because he can speak English fluently, he gets promoted, a 14-year-old boy, to be a boss of of a mother and also like other farmers who are like twice, three times his age. And
yeah,
he, and it's just like they're,
and he wonders why like this girl won't go to the dance with him, because apparently he feels entitled to like, oh, I work with your mom. I'm nice to you. So you, I deserve your love. I don't know. Like
the whole contributions of immigrants being ignored and the rhetoric of immigrants are stealing our jobs, where it's like, no, immigrants are providing a lot of good work into this economy, but you erasing their work.
I feel like that story, it's kind of like a microcosm of like Western colonialism, right? You have this guy with privilege who probably doesn't need a job coming to the farm, learning from the people working the farm, becoming their boss and telling them how to do their jobs, right? And taking credit for their work. Like that is like extractive capitalism, but in the form of like picking worms.
Yeah. So that theme of privilege driving success, you see it multiple times throughout this book. One story that pops into my head is Paris. It's the main character is Red, and she works at a poultry plant. And one of the women there gets promoted to work at the front desk. And when she gets removed from that job because the boss's wife doesn't like the fact that there is like an attractive young lady working in the front, all of the workers that work in line at the factory, they're, you know, prettying themselves up. They're trying to like, you know, look their best to get that job. But eventually that job goes to a high schooler whose father works in the front office. And it's like, yeah, white mediocrity will always get ahead.
I think the thing with short stories is I want to read like the novel versions of a lot of these stories. I feel like, you know, there's a resolution, but it's not like I want to know what happens next, right? But at the same time, it's meant to make you think about like, okay, what happens from now? Like, what does this mean? A lot of these stories end on like very melancholy notes, you know? A lot of parents leaving their children in these stories.
A lot of spouses leaving their significant other as well.
And I guess you can see this as another survival instinct, right? Like a lot of embracing Western culture to survive, right? There's a story about the bus driver whose wife, I guess, starts cheating on him with her boss at the coffee store and like starts looking down on him for not being American enough.
Yeah. Assimilation is a very big theme in this book. I thought it was really like it was sad because the school bus driver has a name. His name is Jai, which means heart in Lao. And there comes a point in the story where the wife says, no one cares. No one knows that Jai means heart in Lao. You're Jay in this country. And English is the only language that matters. And it was just like,
yeah.
Yeah, that hurt. and like the fact that the Jai has a name, but the narrator calls him the school bus driver. And like it actually took me because I had to read the story twice, but I actually thought that character didn't have a name. And I was like, oh no, I'm remembering him by his occupation, which is what happens a lot of the times when we think about blue-collared workers. We don't think about their names. We think about the service that they provide us.
Yeah.
But there's one story that was lighter than the others. And it's actually like one of my favorite stories, Chick-a-Chee, which was about trick-or-treating. I thought it was super cute. Trick-or-treating is an American, like, I don't think the UK or Australia celebrate Halloween in the same way we do?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a very American. I'm sure there was this like a drunk history about it at some point. But yeah, it's definitely an American holiday, and trick-or-treating is definitely an American pastime. And I definitely related to the story as well. My family definitely took us to nicer neighborhoods to go trick-or-treating as a kid.
The end of that story was really cute because the kids are bragging to their friends at school saying, like, we went trick-or-treating. Like, we went to this neighborhood and they were giving us candy. And the lunch lady is overhearing and kind of just sidles in and says, don't you mean trick-or-treating? And the kids are like, no, it's chick-a-cheeing. Like, why are you, like, you're not even part of this conversation. Why are you here, Deborah? and, you know, it was like another example of, like, a child protecting their parents, you know? It's like, yeah, you're not going to tell your parents that it's trick-or-treating, that they're wrong. With chick-a-cheeing, though, when my nephews were here, they moved back to Korea, but they were here for 2 years. And the first year, my cousin wanted to take them trick-or-treating. And, you know, like, because she was really excited about it, because in Korea, you don't have that. So, you know, she dressed up her kids in, like, these very elaborate costumes. And they went to, like, a neighborhood where they can trick-or-treat, but her youngest son, who was 3 years old at the time, he was scared of all of the Halloween decorations, and he was like, no, like, I don't want to go. And but it was, like, the older son, who was five, like, he had a blast. Like, you know, this is not something that you experience in Korea. He had no idea what Halloween was. He was like, why are people dressing up? Why are they giving candy? Why are there monsters? I have no idea. And I can't really explain that to a kid either. It's just like, I don't know why we have this holiday. I guess, you know, something to do with harvest moon and superstitions. How do you explain that to a five-year-old?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Asian holidays have similar creepy vibes to some of them too. A lot of monsters and, like, giving offerings. But yeah, I mean, I've lived in America for like 35 years, and I can't explain Halloween to you what it's about. It's about candy, dressing up.
It's like how we can't explain why knife starts with the letter K.
Exactly.
And we don't pronounce it.
Exactly.
It's just something you grow up with and you don't really question it.
Yeah, that was definitely one of the most lighthearted stories. It was that one and the one about the grandma or the great grandma teaching her great granddaughter about boobs, right, and sex.
Yeah, but that ended in a downer. One of the stories that stood out to me was Edge of the World. And that was one of the stories where the mom leaves. She leaves the family. And there are just, like, parts of it that were just so melancholy. Like, the fact that, like, her mom doesn't have any friends, and the closest that she has to friends is are the Goodwill employees. And it just reminded me how isolating it can be for immigrants, especially refugees in this country.
Yeah, especially if you can't speak the language and you lose your confidence, you lose your sense of self, and, you know, you start lashing out as well, right? That's why she, you know, that story included the narrator talking about how, like, she would accuse her husband of, like, stepping out on her because, like, of a missing sock or because he's working late. But at the same time, like, he's also a blue collar worker who has to work extra shifts to support his family, right?
And the way he copes with the condescending bosses at work was pretty funny. Him
oh,
saying,
yeah, that, was that the one
him
with
saying,
the,
yes, sir. Yeah. He's like, I say yes, sir, as if I'm saying fuck you to my bosses. And I thought that was, like, such a creative and funny way to, you know, rebel against capitalism.
Yeah.
But just, like, that story was, it was probably, like, the most it showed a lot of the Lao refugee immigrant experience. Like, I would say, like, it portrayed the family of a Lao immigrant more.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it portrayed the isolation of, like, a refugee immigrant, because refugees aren't here by choice. They're here because they lost their homes and they had to leave. And so it's not like there was a plan to come to the States and start a new life. They had to, they were dropped here and said, good luck. Right. So, you know, different people cope in different ways, depending on what opportunities you have, depending on how resilient you are to that kind of change. Right. There was another story that had similar themes of, like, a mother trying to cope with a new environment. And that was the Randy Travis short story, where the mother just becomes obsessed with a country singer. And, like, that becomes her tether to living in the States. And, I mean, I think that's also a story about addictive personalities. And, like, I mean, later on the story, she also falls into gambling debt, right?
She trades
one addiction for another, a more destructive one. Right. Like, well, I mean, both addictions involved her spending lots of money and inconveniencing her loved ones. Right. Like, she made her husband drive, what, like, days to go to a Randy Travis concert.
I thought it was really endearing that the husband tried. The father tried. He bought cowboy boots. He tried to be the thing that his wife wanted him to be. But, you know, he couldn't give what she wanted. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Do you feel like this book was much more nicer to the dads than the moms?
I don't know, because, like, a lot of the moms, a lot of the female characters had a lot of personality to them.
That's true.
Like, with Manny Petty, like, you don't know the name of Raymond's sister, but you can definitely picture her. She has a lot. She has a lot of personality, a lot of grit to her, and same thing with. I forgot which story it was, but it was about the older woman who goes into a sexual relationship with a younger man.
I think that was Slingshot. That was the second story, right?
Oh, that was Slingshot. Well, yeah, and you know, you have an older woman who, you know, accepts who she is and goes after what she wants. So you have women characters who are very independent and can navigate their own lives. They make their own choices. And sometimes that their choices is to leave their family. And that makes it just sadder, I guess, because being a refugee means that family is all you have.
Yeah, they're all you have, but they can also be a burden, too. I don't think there's any examples in this book, but there's definitely real life examples where parents came together while coming to the States as a means of survival.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we talked about most of the stories in the book, actually. I think the only one we haven't touched on is the gas station, which is about the, was she a CPA, the tax accountant?
Yeah, yeah.
Any thoughts on that one?
That was one of, like, the more forgettable stories for me. I know a lot of literary critics will disagree with me because from what I've read of reviews, that was one of the standout stories in this collection.
Mm.
And I can see why it struck a chord with a lot of readers. You have a woman who thinks that she is unseen, undesirable, and she's able to have agency, I guess. I don't know. I really don't have anything to say about the story.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm like you. I definitely resonated more with the stories about family and about the immigrant experience. I mean, it was a good read. I got through it. I appreciated that she, you know, like, I appreciate that she was an independent woman that decided to, you know, make him miss her. I'm trying to remember. Yeah.
Cause she leaves. She leaves. And, you know, he says, like, I don't love you. And she's like, well, I know that you're lying.
Was there any story that you wanted to hear more from?
More from? I mean, we haven't talked about this story a lot, but A Far Distant Thing. It's about the friendship between two 12-year-old girls. One is a Lao immigrant girl, and the other is what I'm assuming to be a white girl. They're both from blue-collar families, but the white girl's family is able to move up because the mom or the dad gets a promotion. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the story, the Lao immigrant girl, who is now a woman, she works as a cleaner, and across the street, she sees her childhood friend. And that childhood friend is now, you know, wearing a blazer with a pencil skirt and a suitcase. And you can immediately tell that she's done well for herself in her life. And this is someone that she had a pretty strong bond with as a kid. There was like a very special friendship between them, but she is hesitant to say anything, to say hi to her childhood friend, because she doesn't want her childhood friend to pity her or to ask like, hey, how have you been?
I get this feeling whenever I see someone I haven't seen in like 10 years. At this point, I have high school friends who I haven't seen in 20 years, and it's like, I don't want to talk about the last 20 years. I really don't. And like, I'm not comparing my experience to like someone who, you know, has to work cleaning houses, but that feeling of not wanting to, like, of wanting to keep those childhood memories as they are, you know, as like fond memories. I totally get that.
I mean, I thought what was really sad was her dad. I mean, she still lives with her dad, but they still live in the same basement apartment. And where her friend has been able to move up in the world, the Lao immigrant girl hasn't. It's another commentary on like how race is tied with privilege and success.
Yeah, I mean, this was the story where the dad told his daughter, like, you shouldn't be friends with that girl. Our destinies aren't the same. You shouldn't hope for too much, which is like a theme, another recurring theme that we talked about, right? And it's just sad that he ended up being right.
And I really like the friendship between them, because there's someone in their building who's like a total creep who will say sexy as they were like walking past him. And I just thought it was really endearing that like they would be like, we're 12 years old, you creep. If you tell us that we're sexy one more time, we're going to cut it off. And I mean, it's something that I would see in like a dark indie coming of age film, which is why I kind of wanted that story to be a bit longer. Like, I could picture that being a book.
Yeah, I mean, already it was one of the longer stories in the collection, right? I think that one and Picking Worms. And Manupedi were like the three longest stories in the collection.
Yeah, Manupedi, I wish that was a little bit longer too. The thing with short stories, I don't think I am a short story type of reader. You are left with wanting more, and that is the whole point of short stories, and I'm not for it.
I mean, you're left wanting more, and you're left with thoughts, right? You're left with, okay, there's a lot of content. There's a lot of like really beautiful writing and a lot of like very heartfelt writing in these stories. And I guess, you know, you and I, like, we're the type of people who, like, after watching something, will like go online and search for like spoilers and like commentary.
Oh yeah, like we're the type who like after maybe watching all of the seasons of a show will like go online and like look at the lore and same thing with games too. It's like after like when you finish the main story of the game, you go back and play all of the side quests. Like, you and I are the same in that regard. So short stories,
oh no,
not really our thing.
I finished the side quest before I finished the game.
So. Oh yeah, same here. Yeah. But then there are some games where you have to finish the main story to get to the side quest. But yeah, like, this is why I can never play The Witcher, because I would just end up playing it
for
2 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Any final thoughts on how to pronounce knife?
I thought it was a pretty good collection of short stories. Like I said, I'm not a short story type of reader. A lot of the time, short story collections kind of let me down because it's always a mixed bag of which stories will I like, which stories will I remember. And I really did like Suven Kam's writing style. The prose was very sparse, but also like very exact. And it just like dug deep into you. So yeah. I really appreciated her prose.
I think it's one of those books where if people want to know more about like the refugee experience or even the Lao refugee experience, like it's part of like now it's part of my repertoire of like, here, read these books. Right. Because it's a side of Asian American history that is often erased in favor of, I guess, less downer immigrant experience stories or stories about immigrants in America. Like, you know, these aren't stories about people pulling themselves up from their bootstraps and chasing the American dream. These are stories about people who had to come here to make a life and succeeded in doing so, but aren't necessarily doing well.
Yeah, and it's part of the Asian American experience that gets swept aside.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that it isn't about just trauma. You see people who are living their lives and they have a lot of laughs, and the trauma that they experience, they are able to spin it into like a fun story. You see that in the short story Edge of the World, where a bunch of the Lao immigrant dads are saying, I was on a bamboo raft for like 5 days. And, you know, they're trying to like one up each other on their tragic stories. And yeah, the more tragic it is, they laugh harder. And so I just like the fact that it normalizes the refugee experience and that it's not just all doom and gloom.
Yeah. Well, tell us what you thought of How to Pronounce Knife, stories by Suven Kam Tamangwangsa, on our Goodreads forum, or let us know on Twitter. At Books and Boba. We always love to hear what our listeners think about our book club picks. But on that note, that does it for our discussion of How to Pronounce Knife. Thank you for sticking with us, and I hope you enjoyed our conversation as much as we enjoyed this book. Rira, it's May. It is the Asian month. It's Asian month. Asian Pacific American Heritage Month. 2021 is upon us. What are we reading on this most momentous of months?
We are reading The Silence of Bones by June Herr. This book has been on our TBR pile for, I don't know, 2 years now?
I think ever since we learned about it, because you've been excited about this.
Oh, no, it's been a year. It came out in 2020. Why does it feel like it's been a really long time?
Well, I feel like we announced the publication, like, notice.
Back in 2019?
Yeah, like a long time ago. And even then, you were pretty excited about the story. It's about like women detectives in like imperial era.
During the Joseon dynasty. So that's 1800 Korea. Mm. And the main character is a Tamil who is an assistant to the Korean police because of Confucianism. There's a lot of segregation between men and women, and because the policemen can't go into women's spaces to do their investigation, you have Tamils doing a lot of the work for them. But they're considered lower class, so lots of classism, lots of sexism. I haven't seen a historical mystery novel that's set in Korea before, which was why I was really excited for this book. And June Herr actually came out with a new book this past month called The Forest of Stolen Girls, which is also a historical Korean novel. So she definitely has a brand, and I'm excited to dig into The Silence of Bones.
Yeah, we'll be discussing this book at the end of May, so y'all have a month to read and catch up. The book's been out for about a year now, right? So it should be widely available on your e-readers or your bookstores. If you do go to a bookstore, remember to be safe. But alternatively, you can also buy this book through our bookshop.org portal. And if you do so, you support your local bookstores as well as the Books and Boba podcast, which we appreciate. You can check out our bookshop, which includes lists that Rira has painstakingly curated by going to bookshop.org/shop/books and boba to make your purchase today. And yeah, Rira, congratulations again on your full vaccination. And Yay. Happy Asian Pacific American Heritage Month.
We have a lot of work to do.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. We'll see y'all next time. Bye.
Right, bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Kathy? Kim?
Steve? Where have you been? We haven't seen you for 7 years.
Has it been that long?
Uh-huh.
Oh. I was on a fishing boat. Training. It's part of the plan.
What training? What plan?
The third season of the Korean drama podcast!
Okay, we're doing this again? Okay, but there's no body switching in this one, right?
No! The only thing we're switching is the fact that we're going to watch a good drama this time from 2020 called Itaewon Class, a story about starting a restaurant and a dish that Koreans love called revenge.
I thought you were going to say kimchi jjigae.
I thought you were going to say juk.
Those two. Koreans love those two.
Listen to the Korean Drama Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.